they can hear it. They can see it. They can see each individual flickers, which triggers migraines. Like people with ADHD, we've seen an increase in migraines with fluorescent lights. Like there's a whole lot of reasons that this is helpful. And then for people with like bipolar and depressive disorder, the extra, like the snug feeling around the head actually reduces depressive episodes.
This is William Tincup. You're listening to the You Should Know podcast with Crystal Lay, formerly Crystal Miller Lay. Crystal, how are you doing today?
You know what? I'm doing good. I'm breathing. I can't complain. That sounds horrible. That's a horrible barrier for injury. But yeah, just life is good.
Good. I think we're both, Ryan and I, are a little bit behind the curve as it relates to neurodivergent talent. And neurodivergent employment.
Got to be able to say the word first.
Yeah, that's a neurodivergent person in me.
And just for the record, you didn't even introduce me today. Right to Crystal. You're like, hey, William, I'm here with Crystal.
Your shirt is blinding. Is it all the lines?
Is it moving the lines? Like, is that cool? Yeah, I need to stop wearing lines. I know that's TV 101, right?
Yeah, well, you know. Crystal, act like we have no idea what neurodiversity is and neurodivergent talent is. And let's just start there.
No, it's totally fine. So if we can step back one second, I'd like for people to understand why I'm even qualified to have this conversation with people other than just it's interesting.
100%.
But I always like to know, like, why is this person talking about something? And so just by way of introduction, I run a employer brand recruitment marketing and talent transformation firm. We solve business problems, usually around helping companies hire and retain talent. During the pandemic, I noticed that the coping skills that people had that allowed them to function at work, and as a proudly neurodivergent person, I can tell you I can spot a lot of them. But, you know, when I was reading things online, it was like, yeah, your coping mechanisms that you kind of cobbled together to make work aren't working at home. And I really wanted to understand why. I mean, some of it can be environment. Some of it we can kind of figure out, like, the world was panicked, like all of these things in the beginning, like, okay, yeah, check. But as time went on, those systems were still failing. And so I wanted to understand, like, why, you know, what is it from an employment perspective that we need to do differently so people can function? Because we can't change people's brains, but we can change the way we approach work. So, I was in the middle of getting my master's degree when people were learning to bake bread. I was like, I'm going to go back to school. This sounds good. Sourdough would have been so much easier, y'all. Just saying. But my dissertation.
You lost me to go back to school.
Well, my dissertation was centered around neurodivergence. And specifically, I conducted the largest study in the world on neurodivergent in talent attraction, recruitment, and employment. So looking at, are the systems that we build sufficient for more than one neurotype? And the answer was no. This was not a little study. It was a 3-year study. We surveyed, 2 years of data collection, 1 year of analysis. But we, I studied over 31,000 some odd people. So it's several times larger than the largest study. Quantitatively and 126 qualitatively, meaning I did 126 interviews. So really big population, got to learn quite a bit about where some of our gaps are. And so when you look at what is a neurodivergent person, when we talk about neurodivergence, what we're talking about is just really the way that our brain functions. So we have what's generally known as neurotypical. That's when the brain functions the way we expect the brain to function. You process information typically, right? The way that it's expected. You're able to kind of function in any environment the way that one would generally establish. You might still be a dick, but your brain works the way it's supposed to, right? Supposed to is in air quotes that you really can't see. I'm like sitting here and that's doing my little air quotes. Neurodivergent is when the brain, for whatever reason, sometimes it's chemical, sometimes it's literally the way it's wired. We're still learning a lot about the neurodivergent brain. So a quick aside, autism, for example, there are samples and studies of brains where where you would expect there to be ridges, it's actually smooth brain material and vice versa. So it's not that there's a deformity in the brain or it's wrong. It's just literally wired differently. And as a process of like an output of being wired differently, the way that someone who is neurodivergent experiences the world is sometimes different than expected. Right. So I say that in that way, it's not the cleanest definition in the world, but the reason that I put it that way is because as we learn more and we recognize this isn't like a disorder, you're not broken, you're not damaged, right, you're not less than. Neurodivergence is a sociological construct, right? So the concept is more sociological as opposed to a medical construct that's focused around what therapy do you need, what social security or benefits medicine might you need, what government assistance might you need in order to be able to function. Neurodivergence is just looking at it as like more of a social therapeutic construct. So how can we help you overcome any barriers in your environment to be able to be successful? And so from an employment perspective, we really should be looking at neurodivergence from that sociological perspective, as opposed to the medical construct, because it's A, not our job to fix people, and B, these people aren't broken. They just need a little bit of a different approach. Yeah.
Right. So start us off with the survey. Take us through the survey. What was that about? How did you conduct it?
Yeah. So that's a great question, and I absolutely pulled it up so that we could have a good conversation about that, because it's been a hot minute since I looked at it. So the survey as a whole was really originally meant to look at EVP. Like, that's where it started. Because we attract people off of our employer value proposition, which I have a whole nother episode on how EVP is just fundamentally effed and we need to go back to the drawing board. But the idea behind it is that we're looking at a value alignment from org psych. We're looking at value alignment between the individual and the environment. Well, that's great, except we build EVP the same general way, right? One way. And if we're saying there are different ways of processing information and there's different neurotypes, do those different neurotypes synthesize that information and put the same level of importance on all of the same things that we expect them to, right? Are they reacting typically or divergently to what we're putting out? And so I wanted to understand that. So that maybe part of the problem is the way we're bringing people in to begin with, because we know neurodivergent people tend to be on performance improvement plans and have lower overall work satisfaction scoring in the first 6 months of employment. So that has to have something to do with the recruitment phase. So that's what I set up. What I ended up getting, though, was a lot bigger than that. So quantitatively, the data was largely around conducting an EVP survey, right? So I will step back and say our EVP surveys are a little bit different than what a lot of agencies put out. And that's not a sell or I'm better than, worse than anyone else. We're just very focused on person environment fit. And so the thought process behind that is people who don't work for you do not care at all what your values as a company are. They just don't. They care about their values. And so what you need to find out is, do their individual values align with what they're going to experience in their work environment day in and day out? Can you fulfill what they need to self-actualize and perform? Because the point of EVP wasn't supposed to be a sales gimmick or a let me tell you why you should love us. It was meant to drive business revenue. So in order to do that, you have to help the individual worker self-actualize. They can't self-actualize if they're not being fulfilled from a values perspective, if they're not being fulfilled from a needs perspective. So that's how we build EVP. So I took that survey, which we'll have a whole different conversation about that at some point too, but it's fascinating in and of itself. 166 questions around values. And then at the end of that, appended questions around neurodiversity and neurodivergence. So do people consider themselves to be neurodivergent? Is that because they've self-identified or do they have a diagnosis? Either way, do they have accommodations at work? If they have accommodations at work, like, were they self-accommodated or did they disclose to the employer and then get accommodations from the employer? If they didn't disclose, why didn't they disclose, right? And so we found some really interesting things out in the survey, one of which is that for the people who didn't disclose, which, by the way, was 9 out of every 10 neurodivergent people chose not to disclose. So their accommodations were all self-accommodated. But for the people that didn't disclose, it was because of experiences they had during the recruitment process that made them feel psychologically unsafe. They didn't feel like it was safe to disclose that information. Like, okay, we have work to do. So that was interesting. Qualitatively, we saw some really interesting things as well. So quantitatively, a larger percentage of people were willing to say, yes, I have neurodivergence. It's either self-identified or, you know, medically identified and diagnosed. When we were talking with people in interviews, that number again went down. So what did we learn from that? People don't feel safe disclosing verbally that they have what's considered to be a disability or something that may make them be anything other than everybody else at work, right? And not supposition. They literally talked about it.
Do you think that they're not divulging this because of stigma or because of the environment that the workplace has created?
Yes, to both.
I was going to also add that they don't want to do anything that ding them out of the process.
Yeah.
So if they discuss that in the attraction phase, like with a recruiter, right? If it comes up as like, okay, do you need any accommodations? Well, in their mind, my gut tells me, in their mind, if they say yes, that puts them either further down on the list or knocks them out or whatever. Right. And so they just don't disclose. I mean, Crystal, you're the expert. So is that true?
Yeah. In a very large way, it is true. It's not always the case for everyone, right? There's exceptions, but by and large, that was the feedback that we got back is like, it's not safe. And so following this survey, I went and ran a different experiment. And I wouldn't call it anything like super academically sound. I just went and applied for a couple hundred jobs and said, I have a neurodiagnosis. You know, I have ADHD, which by the way, I totally do. So since I was 8, if you can't tell it from this conversation, there will be something shiny. It'll happen. So disclosed upfront, right? Which I, when I had jobs, like that was never something that I disclosed. It also wasn't really asked, so didn't have to, but did disclose it up front in 100 different jobs that I applied for. And then I didn't disclose it in 100 other jobs. In some of the jobs, we had someone else with a similar resume, like almost exact, like fake resumes, whatever, but go in and apply. So I would get job rejections back like within an hour. They would, with the same qualifications, not get one back. Now, is it because of that? I have absolutely no idea, right? Like, I can't prove it. So like I said, it's not academically sound, but it certainly reinforced what I saw and what I learned in those conversations and in the survey, which was there's a belief that disclosing at the recruitment process is going to lead to higher levels of rejection rates than if you don't disclose. It's problematic.
Now, do you know if the responses, the rejections that you were getting back were automated or were they from a human recruiter?
A lot of them were automated, right? They would have had to have been for some of them. Like one of them, my favorite one was literally 6 minutes after I applied, there was a rejection. So it was like, I doubt someone in their ATS system has it set up to say, if they disclose a, you know, then reject them. That would be like begging for a lawsuit, right? So I doubt that's the case. And actually that specific company, after doing a little more digging, what I found out is that they just arbitrarily reject a certain number of candidates. They don't review all of their candidates. That's a different problem for a different day. But if you happened to be someone that was neurodivergent, which is not a small population, by the way, we haven't discussed that yet, but since it's Pi Day, we can talk about pie charts that came out of that. Like a big part of the findings of that was like, how prevalent is neurodivergence? Has it changed from our belief of 15%? It has. It's actually closer to 20% with a diagnosis, and almost 1 in 4 if you include those who self-identify. That self-identify and refuse to identify, right? Because you have the way that we split this out, and actually, if I can pull it up, I'm happy to share it with you on screen. But the way that we split this out, it was like, I have it. With a diagnosis, I have it self-identified. I don't know if I am or not. I choose not to disclose, or no, I'm not. and I choose not to disclose was almost 7% of population. And that's fascinating, right? Because they could have said, I don't know, they could have said no. They said, I am not answering that question, which means some percentage of that are. And when we looked at like the responses, we only needed like 2% of that population to have been, yeah, I have it, I'm just not telling you. And that would have put us at 1 in 4. So think about any employer.
Let me, Crystal, let me ask you a question.
Sorry, go ahead.
Right. 1 in 4. No, it's okay. The question I want to ask is a little, it's tangential. So the talent attraction journey, if you will, that a lot of employers have seem to be kind of LCD, lowest common denominator, mm-hmm. right? And that could be a good thing, I guess. We could make an argument for that. But it could also be a bad thing because we're not making kind of personalized experiences and personalized journeys, et cetera. So the question is, and you're really, I just want to get your take on where do you see AI helping us create personalized journeys or helping the candidates create personalized journeys or a brand's creating with AI, creating personalized journeys for people that are divergent.
So that's
a lot of narrative to unpack. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would say that's a tricky question. Does it have the potential to do it? Absolutely. But this is a really big but.
But
systems, AI systems are trained off of the input that it's given. And so part of what it will train to is who you reject.
Right.
So if your employment population is made up of a high level of divergent people, and that's been disclosed and they have that data, it'll train on that. Conversely, if you're rejecting neurodivergent candidates more than you're bringing them in, it's going to train on that too. So there's a really high likelihood that your AI will probably reinforce your organizational biases more than it will break them, at least at this point.
Got it. Okay.
Have you seen a big difference pre-pandemic to post-pandemic?
In terms of disclosures or?
Let's say there's a lot.
Identification.
Like, identification, like yeah. And candidates and people disclosing as they're applying. Was it less safe for people pre-pandemic as opposed to post-pandemic where there's more comfort level in disclosing?
I don't have hard and fast numbers on this. I'm going to tell you my opinion based off of the things that I've read. So anecdotes tell me that people feel less safe disclosing their neurodivergence now, which is odd to me because we have a much higher conversation level around that. But we also have a much more protracted job search. And so anytime that you're seeing protracted job searches, people are going to do what they can to minimize their own risk, which often means not disclosing. When we look at the data, the actual data coming in, there is a higher number of people being diagnosed. Now, part of that is we continue to evolve our own understanding of neurodivergence. And as that happens, then we're going to see more neurodivergent diagnoses, right? As doctors become more aware of different things, as the people conducting different evaluations become more aware of different diagnoses and the way that that looks and feels, we'll see higher occurrences of that. But there was a big uptick of it because there was a big uptick of people seeking out mental health supports during and after the pandemic. And as you do that, well, things that you have will become identified and disclosed. So what we're actually seeing a lot of, and it's fascinating to me, the ADHD uptick was expected, right? And that actually can be caused by a lot of different things. Somebody said adult ADHD isn't a thing. That's the stupidest effing thing I've ever heard. If you had ADHD as a kid, you have it as an adult. You do not grow out of it. But you 100%. Do learn how to cope with it, right? And so that's good. But for adults who hadn't received that diagnosis yet, like we expected to see more of that. What we didn't necessarily expect to see was an uptick in autism diagnoses. And we are seeing that, which is a double-edged sword for adults, right? Because a lot of the therapies and systems set up for help with that are designed around children, not around teenagers and adults.
Right.
So they're diagnosed with this thing that they don't fully understand, but it may be like, hey, this is why you've always struggled with a lot of noise, or couldn't stand to hear someone eat, and also, you know, maybe don't have a lot of friends, right? Whatever the case may be, or this might be why you struggle with changes in your routine and language flexibility. There's all these different things. Well, great, but that doesn't help you necessarily learn how to navigate that. So we're seeing an uptick in diagnoses, but no uptick in subsequent support for these people. And that's really difficult because it really is going to fall on the employer to help create an environment where this person can actually navigate their own diagnoses and what they need.
So return to office, currently known as RTO. It's the movie coming to a theater near you. What's your take on neurodivergent talent and RTO? Are you currently thinking about it?
No, I am a lot. It's a double-edged sword. Like, on the one hand, the reality is the office offers a lot more structure than a home environment does. When we're talking about structure, I want to be really clear here, because you can build your own systems and structure with inside your environment, and you know how to navigate that, right?
Right.
But so for an ADHD person, while it's probably not more fun, and maybe not as comfortable as being in their own environment, it might actually be helpful to keeping them to task. And I say them, including myself, right? Like, you kind of learn what you learn. But it depends. It very much depends on how the environment is set up. So the open office environment where you're walking into this giant room, like, that is a nightmare for someone with ADHD. If that's your office environment, return to work is probably not something I would force upon your population. Right. If you have, you know, quiet spaces to work and individualized work areas where people can actually focus, and then you have some level of meetings for social interaction and then back to focus times. If people are able to really set a structured calendar, return to work can be a really good thing for productivity, but it's so organizationally dependent. And anytime you force someone to do something that they're not ready to do, you can expect diminished productivity. So the idea of forcing people back to work doesn't sit well with me. To me, that's a real estate decision and not a productivity decision.
100%.
But it's being made by a population, a generational population that spent their formative years in an office, right? So we all live off our own bias. We have biases, right? We operate off of that. And so their bias is, this is the way that we should do things. So anytime there's a dip in productivity, or I have a giant lease payment I have to make on all of this giant real estate that no one's in, there's going to be that feeling. We need to get back to the way things were. But studies are not bearing it out.
As if the way we were in 2019 was awesome.
Right.
So that's assuming it was actually good.
One of the things I'm really interested in as you talk is, as a neurodivergent person or talent, let's just say, are you on a maturity curve of understanding your own needs as being a neurodivergent person? Again, early adoption, mainstream, laggard, like, you understand kind of what makes you tick or where you thrive. Like, we've talked about how do you solve for thrive for a while, but it seems like there's also an individual responsibility there's an organizational responsibility too.
Absolutely. No, that's fair. So, like, for myself, yes, I have a really good understanding of what I need to work and how to make that work. And I've used accommodations since I was eight. Right. So I have probably in the minority as it relates to understanding my own diagnoses. My parents did a really good job of making sure the school system was involved in teaching me how to accommodate and advocate for myself early on. That's not the norm. Right. So what we often see is, even with younger workers who had IEPs and individualized education plans and 504s, you know, special education plans to help them get accommodations, they're not taught how to transfer that into a work environment. And there's no real teaching of that in employment either, right? Because let's be real, we're not training recruiters on that. We're not really training HR people on that. So unless you just happen to have someone in HR who has a psychology or social work background, you probably don't have the right people in place for that. So once you graduate, my point to all of that is, once you graduate high school, university, and the work environment is not set up to help you understand any of that. most people will buy a couple books or see a psychologist or a therapist for a few months to a couple of years to like get some coping mechanisms. Maybe that's building lists, relying on Outlook, whatever it is. And that's about as far as it goes, because that's about as far as we've helped people go, right? Yes, you're responsible for your own needs and understanding, but you can only do what's put in front of you or available to do. And we as a country, and really the broader world, like I'm not just going to like put this to the United States. There's a lot of countries that struggle with this. Don't have systems set up to really help people navigate that unless they were transitioned during high school. So our kids will get the benefit of a better working world, but our generation, not as much. There are things that you can do though. Like for anyone who's listening, who's like, hey, I'm neurodivergent and I'm screwed. hey, welcome to the club. But there are things that can help you. If you have what's called an IDD, it's an intellectual disability, a diagnosis. So ADHD, learning processing disorder, dyspraxia, dyslexia, sensory deprivation, like not deprivation, sensory processing disorder, Tourette's, any number of things, then you are eligible to take part in a program called vocational rehabilitation. Every state has one. And this is also good for employers to understand, because every state has programs for you to utilize people who are part of vocational rehab, and you will get fabulous tax benefits and also supports to help you build programs that will help a broader number of people that have neurodivergence in your organization. And if you are putting together a work environment that supports the neurodivergent, you will become what your actual goal is, which is to be neurodiverse. A person is neurodivergent. An organization is neurodiverse. But for you to be neurodiverse, you have to have the systems in place to be able to welcome those people and then stick. Sorry, tangent.
Let's dig a little deeper into that. How does an organization, now obviously, I think you may have thrown this out earlier, X number percent of organizations are not neurodiverse at the moment. For a company that's trying to be or really wants to be and they want to invest in this area, what do they need to do? How do they do this?
Yeah. So one.
Step one.
Yeah. Step one. Identify your why, right? So, and sometimes your why is like because it's morally and ethically the right thing to do. And that can be a perfectly fine why. But if you don't have a why you want to be something, the chances of you sticking through that program, like sticking through the pain of putting that program in and integrating and training your workforce, it's not going to stick. So understand your why. Once you have that, look at who's doing things right. And I'm not going to say doing it right, because no one's doing it all the way right. We're all still learning, which is great, because that means if you try something and it gets mucked up, you will not be alone. But companies that are doing and really investing a lot into understanding neurodivergence and how to work that into something in a more meaningful way than we built, you know, this program for 12 interns with autism. By the way, I have an autistic stepson. I have an absolute love for people with autism. I think it's great that we're building employment programs for them. But hiring 12 interns and saying now we're neurodiverse, that's not a thing, right? That you do not get cookies or brownies for that. But Microsoft doing a really good job, has done a really good job with neurodivergent friendly design. Making sure that even from the attraction process, that what they're putting in is accessible, their language. So if you're trying to build something out, your job descriptions and your job posts, your career site, your recruiting materials, start there. We use a lot of flowery language and a lot of subjective terms in our job posts and job descriptions that make it really difficult for someone with any number of neurodiverse diagnoses, neurodivergent diagnoses, to be able to understand. And so taking out the one that I pick on all the time is must have good communication skills. What the hell does that mean? Like, what does it mean? I mean, we kind of know, right? We know that what you're really trying to say is you need to be able to communicate well with a broad audience of people, generally speaking, various different levels. You need to be able to have good, you know, written presentations, whatever it is, whatever it is that you need that makes you put that in something. If it's not just, well, it was in the legal job description, then say what you need, right? A lot of neurodivergent diagnoses have language flexibility issues. So they will take things very literally. right? If you say, I need good communication skills, and they can't quantify that in their own mind, you are inadvertently discouraging that person from applying to your organization. And that's one example of dozens.
All right. So I'll preface this by saying I may get hate. All good. Mm-hmm. Because it's really something that I'm interested in.
For
those that are watching, they'll get the thumbs up. The other one, why are you laughing at
them? There you go.
All right, so the question I have is, and I'm with all of this. I fully understand what we're talking about. But at what point does an employer, where's that line? What's that point that the employer has to look at this and say, all right, guys, look, we're talking about communication skills. I can't list out 97 things on every job description. What is that line when you're working with an employer where you're finding they're getting frustrated and they're like, okay, Crystal, back up. Like, this is a job description. Like, we're way across the line.
So I'm usually having to do that with them, not the other way around. So very, very rarely will I add to someone's job post. I'm almost always cutting out a lot of extraneous junk that they don't really need. That doesn't really add to, but definitely takes away. So just as a point of fact, most organizations' job posts are way, way, way too long. And they conflict themselves. Their language is confusing. So a lot of what I do is cut out, not add to. So just there. But I think the broader point of like, when is it too much, is a valid question. And I'm going to answer it in a really offensive way, if you're ready for it.
Yeah, and I asked that question. I asked the question out of love because it's really something I can see an employer saying, I'm trying my best, but what is?
Okay, so here's my offensive way of answering this question. So would you ask that if what we were talking about was a pregnant woman? Would you ask how much is too much if what we're talking about is a black man? And the answer to that in both areas.
I understand a bit. Yeah.
So if we're not going to do it for other minority populations, why are you doing it for the largest minority population on the planet? And the answer is because I can't see it. Right? I can't see it. I don't understand it. And it's hard. It's hard is not a good reason to not do right by a human being. So that's generally the conversation I literally have with organizations. It is not comfortable, but it is
effective.
It
also bleeds over into, you know, just pull your boots up by the bootstraps and just get on with it. So, you know, which is an older generation's kind of way of just saying, yeah, I don't want to hear any of that. Just go do your job. What is that phrase that people say, what gets measured, what matters, what matters is what gets measured. I don't know who said it or whatever.
Hey, but, Biden, what are you trying to say?
Measure what matters. Yeah.
That's nice.
Sorry.
You've
been a recruiter. You've been in the trenches doing this stuff for a long time.
I got the end of that, but I missed the question. What was the question? Sorry.
Oh, I haven't asked the question.
Oh, then keep going. Okay.
So, yeah, it takes me a while to get there. That's why the Biden reference is so wonderful. Who's responsible for neurodiversity at a company? Because if we say everyone, my fear is we say everyone, that's not going to work. And if we say it's one person, Sally and DEI, inclusion, I guess, would be something that we would be under. That doesn't work for me either.
Yeah, no.
No, that's me, by the way. So who's responsible for neurodiversity?
So my answer is always the buck stops with the CEO, right? Like, who's really responsible for making sure an organization is diverse? It's the CEO. Why? Because there are so many different parts to this. And, you know, everybody's got a hand in different areas of it. There shouldn't be one person that's responsible for it other than the CEO, because you're only going to be able to execute and really influence your area. Now, what I do in recruitment may influence what Sally in DEI is able to do, but from 100%. An HR perspective, we, particularly in the United States, look at DEIB backwards, right? Diversity is the outcome and the output. Inclusion, equity, and belonging is the program, is the focus. And if you do that right, then diversity will follow, right? But when we focus on diversity as the upfront measurement, like we kind of, you're putting the cart before the horse. For recruiting, like, because we know that recruiting is actually where a fair amount of this gets mucked up, just from jump, the expectation, the responsibility is to make sure that the materials that we're putting out, the messages that we're sharing, the process by which we recruit people and interview them, it's accessible, it's fair, it's equitable, not equal, cool, equitable, right? And so that is the responsibility of recruitment. And then once someone is brought
full
in,
stop.
Yep. Okay.
Okay.
Were,
so
go ahead. You were gonna. You
here's
asked,
the but... here's the thing that's a rub. The push in the last 5 years has been to standardize interviews, right? We all read the same stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Standardize interviews. So it's going to reduce our bias. It's not going to eliminate bias, but it's going to reduce bias. We're going to give everyone the exact same interview. Okay, sounds good in theory. But what if you're dealing with someone that's divergent, that's different, and where a standard interview, that standard, same standard interview would make them not shine in the same way as a typical neurotypical person? I'm dealing with this conflict, right? In my mind, not anywhere else.
No, it's okay.
In my mind of like standardized interviews. And okay, but what if someone's neurodivergent? How do we make the interview to where they can shine?
So,
Ryan, were you going in the same place?
Yeah,
I was. And Chris, I'll let me add on to that. And mm-hmm. You know, she'll kill me if she ever hears this, but I highly doubt my daughter's ever going to listen to it. And if she does, she ain't going to get this far into the episode. So I'm
100%.
So she is on an IEP. And she has trouble taking tests. She'll do really well on her assignments, but the test, she'll get 4 out of 60. She just can't do it, right? So they take her out of class. They put her into the small group. She works with a woman. She studies. She does her work. She just can't do it in that open environment. She needs that woman with her in order to understand and really do well on the test. And she just had one the other day. We were talking about earlier this week. This week she was studying. She got a 91% on her test, which was fantastic. She was super excited. But the 5 days leading up to that was just absurd for her. She was frustrated, trying to study, trying to understand, trying to learn. And she knew the work. And she said, I know this. I know how to do this. I don't need to study. I understand. But if she takes that test in the regular classroom, all bets are off. Like, she's not passing. She's getting 4 or 5 right out of the 60.
The metaphor of standard interviews.
For sure.
Exactly. And so that's where I was going. I was going to use the other example. Yours is probably better.
No, it's totally fine. No, that's a really, look, these are really valid questions and challenges that we need to solve for. Fortunately, there is a solution for that, and it kind of comes from the IEP. So for this specific question, we need to standardize the process so that we're able to objectively grade. Check. All you have to do is give these people the question in advance. You should give it to everybody in advance, because by the way, your interview quality will go way up if you're not sticking people on the spot. Sometimes you need to actually judge what someone will do on the spot. Sometimes that's a valid thing. You can add that in as a final piece of your interview while still giving everyone else the questions in advance so that they can be able to look at it, think about it, process, and come up with a meaningful answer. It doesn't generally have to be days and days and days in advance, but a good rule of thumb is somewhere between 24 hours and 5 days, right? So depending on how long it takes for you to interview out and to schedule out. That also, by the way, can be a good way of keeping candidates engaged, which can lower your ghost rate regardless of their neuro status.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. Another thing is, like specifically to your daughter, like if I were trying to understand what kind of process I might need to design to make sure that your daughter is able to successfully become employed, and that's probably something vocational rehab would do with her, are what was called pre-ets in high school. It's the high school version of vocational rehab. We'd look at things like Okay, well, what are the things that are distracting her? So is it visual distractions? Mm-hmm. And if so, then what might be helpful is for the company to be able to have alternate interview environments so that you're not interviewing someone in a glass conference room, which may seem really cool because they can see everything going on around you, but it's actually super distracting. So, right. You know, so alternate interview environments, if you're doing Zoom interviews or, you know, whatever video interviewing platform you use, like there is a need to be able to see someone up front to make sure you're not getting catfished. Check. Got it. But after that, allowing them to decide if they want their camera off is great, because even like with ADHD, that can be very distracting. There's some rejection issues that people have, body dysmorphia, all sorts of things that can actually improve your interview quality if you just allow people to turn their cameras off. And you can make it optional, right? Yeah. So people who don't need that won't do it, and people who do will. But yeah. These are little accommodations that don't take away from the equity of an interview structure while still allowing right. someone to be able to focus. Mostly stop with the dumb games. Like the things that are Forbes and Business Insider worthy because they're funny. Ha ha. You got that person by offering them a Coke can and they didn't ask you where the recycle bin was. That makes you a dick. It does not make you cool. So there are so many reasons that is not neuro-friendly. And it's not even like, even someone who's neurotypical may struggle with what to do with that, because you've already interjected someone into an unfamiliar environment. They're not familiar with your structures. They don't know what's overstepping. Culturally, we teach all kinds of different things depending on where you are in the United States as to whether or not it's even appropriate to ask what to do with this, right? So where you think that you're being cool and all psychologically savvy by like finding out if they asked you what to do with this thing or offering to wash out their coffee cup, you're not. You're freaking somebody out. They're having all kinds of little battles in their head. And it serves no real purpose about what to be in your office.
And what qualifies that interviewer to try to get psychological on somebody, oh, yeah. right? That's, I mean, you're just playing mind games and at that point. I mean, I might be overstepping here, but I think a lot of this is common sense, really.
Mm. I mean, it is.
I feel like it's common sense in the fact that...
I'm going to go darker. I think it's just men behaving badly is basically what a lot of this comes down to, at least historically, maybe even currently. It's just guys being dicks because that's how they came up, because that's what was in front of them was other guys being dicks. Now, I might be wrong about that.
Like, I think...
I did have a question.
I think people like read these Forbes magazines.
This is my last question.
Oh, sorry.
Where's the... Well, the intersection between cultural differences and divergent things that we need to be looking at, like what could be a cultural difference could also be misread as something that's divergent and vice versa.
Oh, I don't know that I'm qualified to answer that question. I think you might have stumped me, but I think
it only took me 40 minutes.
Oh, the over under was like 6 minutes. So you definitely won that one.
Right.
You know what I'm thinking about, right? Okay.
I mean, like, so things like shaking hands and,
eye contact.
Yeah. So I think unless you're a psychologist, and I'll even go so far as like, I'm studying psychology. I am not qualified to ascertain this from any particular individual right now, right? But I would say unless you're a psychologist, unless you're trained in behavioral psychology to understand why someone may or may not do things, like don't. Like recognize not everyone's going to be comfortable shaking your hand, and it might be cultural, it might be germs, it might be, you know, neurodivergence. You don't really know. So anytime that there's a question of that, I think what it boils down to is like, does it matter? Like, is it going to impede the way that they function within your organization? Sometimes that might be yes, but most of the time it's not. And so if we just use, does this actually matter as our guiding star, then I think that'll help a lot in employment. This morning I woke up, and as people do, I opened up Facebook and like, what were my notifications? And there was something in the human resources forum
Facebook. You do that. I don't do that. I wake up, I give my
social
wife
media
a kiss,
platform of choice,
I read the Wall Street Journal, and then I get a cup of coffee.
None of that is true.
Okay.
No, I just roll out of bed and I end up at the gym, and then I sit in the car for 30 minutes and wonder if I'm going in. It's all good.
Well, yeah, I have those days too. I get that. I was looking at notifications, and on the human resources forum, there was this woman that's in human resources and recruiting, and she was very proud of herself because she had found the red flags on this candidate because that person had listed out that they had a concealed carry license in the license and certification section of the application. She's like, huge red flag, right? Like that tells me everything I need to know about that. Wait, what? So
they don't live in Texas.
Right. We put our guns on the back of our trucks where they belong.
Can't take our guns.
Yeah, but so like as you dove into it, like in her mind, she was really doing her employer Goodwill a service by like weeding out this person because they'd answered it. And I'm looking at this going like, this could have been a neurodivergent candidate who saw. Mm-hmm. List your licenses and certification and thought, I need to disclose all of this because they asked me to. Right. So we may think that what we're doing is helpful, but often it's really not. So if we go back to, does it hurt that they disclosed this? No, probably not. You know, does it help that they disclose this? It may not really matter, but we might want to have a conversation with them, leave your guns at home. Right. So, you know, whatever. But if we use that kind of rationale in our thinking, it doesn't add much more time, but it certainly can create more equitable employment experiences.
Drops mic, walks off stage. Crystal Lay, thank you so much for coming on the show and schooling Ryan and I on both neurodivergent and neurodiversity. So we appreciate you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Love what you're doing.